It's Wednesday, December 15th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 216 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 54 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
And this is Chris.
Two announcements, both Fear the Con related. Some point here, we'll do the bonus episode with all the good stuff on Fear the Con. But there are two things I want to make you guys aware of. First,
Three things.
Okay.
Yes. Did you know that I am making a game specifically for Fear the Con?
I did not.
Yes, I am.
What are you making for Fear the Con?
It's going to be a sci-fi game. It's going to be on a spaceship. It's going to involve insanity. And there's going to be a traitor mechanic. More, I cannot say.
It's like a board game or
no,
a role-playing game.
Yes.
Have you picked a mechanic for it?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm developing it now.
All right. Well, I'm interested to hear how this turns out.
It's going to be different.
Are you up to three games you're running now? Or
No. So far, I'm only running one, and this will be my second. I will probably only run two.
I'm running four and playing
No,
two.
Look at me. I'm Dan. I'm running four.
Actually, I was thinking about doing four as well.
The four I'm running, I should have two of them posted by the time this episode drops. Two I'm playing in. I'm saving a spot for Chris Mays, because it sounds like he's going to be coming and running the sequel to White Man's Planet.
Yes.
And then also Mikey Mason manned up after we talked about an episode how nobody will game my own settings for me.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to run a Skies of Glass game at Fear the Con. It's funny, though, because second to last time he came down to visit, in a car ride, he was asking me for plot ideas. So, well, I guess that's not entirely true. He was more asking me for kind of concepts, what sort of plots work. But anyway.
I signed up for a Don't Rest Your Head game. So
I signed up for the game that you've been talking about for 2 years now, Dread the Last Hurrah.
Oh, the Last Hurrah. Good game.
So the two announcements that I came with is, first off, with this episode in the show notes, there's going to be links to two different Fear the Con flyers. And the reason we're putting those out there is we will be hanging those up in stores around the St. Louis area. But if you live in some place nearby and you've got a gaming store or comic shop or a bookstore or whatever, and you're willing to print off and hang up a couple flyers for us, we very much appreciate that and figured we'd at least give you the tools and the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, so, I'd love to see some real off-the-wall places for them, too. Like, I've thought about Bredco's probably be a good place to hang them up.
Libraries, they take those down
schools.
After a week.
Adult bookstores.
Go back every week,
be
then.
Good.
Oh, yeah.
We should put them in rest stops near the state line so Chris and Pat see them.
Uh-huh. Put one right above a glory hole.
The other thing is Fear the Con 4 is going to be the site of a regional tournament for UFS, which is the Universal Fighting System. And this is a card game that has really been taken on by its fans. And what I mean by that is the company that owned the card game apparently went under or something to that effect. And the fans of the game stepped up, bought out the company, and now run it.
What?
And one of the people that has a real love for this game is a guy by the name of Derek, who's been just a real trooper. I mean, this is just a grade A booter. So I just got much love for this guy. But he has gotten Fear the Con 4 set up as one of their regional tournaments. And in case you've never heard of it, basically what UFS is you create a deck based on a character from a fighting game. Now, for example, they featured fighters from things like Street Fighter, Soul Calibur, Tekken, Deathstalker. But let's say you wanted to make Batman. you could start picking out powers until you have a deck that looks like Batman.
What if I am Batman and I want to play you?
Well, then you could make a deck that looks like me.
It'd be I think Batman's deck's going to be a lot higher if we're talking fighting.
Yeah.
But then you sit down and you play out a fight, like a Mortal Kombat type fight between these two characters that you've created. So they're, as I said, they're going to be doing a tournament for this at Fear the Con. And the winners of this tournament stand to get prizes such as uncut sheets, boxes of cards, and also a first round bye at the Nationals. So when they actually go into the national levels, you will get a first round pass. Now, if you're interested in signing up for this, this will be on the Fear the Con site at fearthecon.com. The only caveat is because of the prize support that's involved with this and because of the fact that it's a fan-run effort, there is a $5 ticket charge for this tournament. Now, just to be clear, that $5 ticket, you can buy it on Fear the Con site as a separate type of ticket. You'll need that to enter the tournament. It will cover that tournament, all of that tournament, and only that tournament. So if you want to get involved in this, you want to pick that up, And from everything I've been reading on this, it sounds like a really neat game. Hmm. And I will link some information off the show notes. So if you're interested in learning more about that game or checking out a starter deck or something like that, then I'll give you the information so you can find that. All righty. Chris?
Yes, Dan.
You
hello.
Had a something you wanted to discuss that was sent in by a listener, and I'll let you go ahead and set that up.
It was one of the comments that was made from episode 214, and it's from someone named Matt R-K. I don't know if that's just Matt Rick or what, but...
It's R-K.
R-K.
It's a math problem.
All right. Thank you. And he says, if we could address the topic of player interference, and what he means by that is a situation where one player, not the character, interferes with another player's actions. I'll read the rest of it here because it's pretty short. He says, it almost always takes the form of advice and can range from simple tactical observations, and he describes a little tactical opportunity there, but he goes, I find this to be one of the most pernicious issues in his games. The reason I don't simply outlaw it is that most of the campaigns that he runs, he's playing with both experienced gamers and people totally new to RPGs. Most of the advice the players are giving each other is extremely useful. They're mentioning things that I as a GM would tell them anyway, such as this spell doesn't work on undead, or your wizard would probably know that. But the problem is that even though each individual bit of interference is totally justified, it can get to the point where the new players become totally paralyzed. It comes to their turn to initiative, and they simply look at the other players and ask, what should I do? And he's curious as to what some of our thoughts are on that. And in a certain sense, I can see where a lot of that comes from. I mean, I can see the motivation behind a lot of players wanting to do that in the sense that, you know, they see somebody new at the table and they want to try and enhance, make the experience good for them. And so they're more than happy to offer their advice. But I think there does come a point, particularly with new players, where they do get a little overwhelmed with what's being thrown at them. They're trying to just grasp what they can they actually do in a turn, and then here they've got all these things being thrown at them, which may very well be beyond their capacity. But at what point do you think that threshold is really reached, and when should players learn to, you know, back off?
Well, let me break this into two separate issues. The first is rules-based advice. What you can do, what you can't do, moving past this guy provokes an attack of opportunity, things like that. Which I think as long as they're kept in balance, I don't know per se I can give you a really specific rule. It's just kind of one of those things you have to have enough social tact to feel where the person's benefiting from the advice versus where they're getting turned off. But I think that type of advice I would pretty heavily encourage, provided it's not shutting the other person down. Now, if it's shutting the other person down, I don't know what to say outside of learn how to read people. And if you can't do that, I don't know that I've got any quick little platitudes that you can use to learn that.
Well, you know, and I think, too, that part of what needs to happen is a game master needs to be very, very aware of this going on and making sure, even from the get-go, that he should tell that new player, if he does receive rules advice, that he doesn't necessarily have to take it. He can go ahead and really do whatever he's thinking he might want to try, and whether the consequences are good or bad, it's worth it for him to try just from the sheer experience of trying it and doing a trial and error and see what works and what doesn't, rules-wise.
Yeah, I actually think that one of the best ways to learn is from your mistakes. So I discourage people, especially players, to just dictate to a new player or to any player that kind of rules help or whatever. Just if they're going to do something that might be detrimental to them or the party, if it's not going to TPK, then who cares? Let them learn from it. They won't make that mistake again.
Yeah, provided,
you know,
GM's
if you tell them don't do it because it could be bad, that is not the same as if they do it and it's bad and they're like, oh crap, I won't do that again.
Well,
but, you know,
provided the GM's not an ass.
Well, yes. Now,
because I've seen GMs who'd be like, you didn't know? Too bad. You're all screwed.
Yeah.
You know? Your character's dead or maimed or the party.
And if you've got a GM like that, you should find a new group.
Yeah.
So,
agree.
Yeah, that's a bigger problem here.
Well, okay. I guess that's one of the things that gets to me is if you've reached the point where someone feels the need to say, oh, hey, if you do that, here's all the penalties for it. To me, the rules are then getting in the way of what you're trying to get that player to do. That player's trying to role play. They throw out an idea. And at that point, it's like, well, attack of opportunity is one of the examples given. Yeah, that's helped me in the past. I haven't done things that I would have otherwise, and I feel I lost something for it. Like, mm-hmm. My character would have done that thing. It would have done the stupid thing and risked himself.
Another aspect of this that I really have an issue with, and I really, really try not to ever do it, is if you are in combat and my turn is up, I've already gone, and it goes on to the next player, and they're about to do something. I'm like, ooh, you shouldn't do that, or no, this is going to mess up something I've set up, or, oh, if you do this, it'll help me next time, or if you do this, it'll help the next player in line. I actively do not say that, because technically my action for that round, for that 6 second bit of action, is done, and it won't be my turn until I come around again. And I see a lot of that. I'll see a lot of that happen where I've already done my thing, but, oh, by the way, I'm going to do this as well. Well, it's not really your turn. And I know maybe that's being a little bit too literal about, you know, sticking to it or whatever, but I think that adds to part of the realism, because, you know, do you get what I'm saying?
I'm completely
with you. You can't
be
acting outside of your what you've already done. Your allotted time has already been, you know, has just been taken up already.
Yeah, I totally support you, because one of the issues I have and I've had in past with combats are sitting around and having too much out of character conversation. And that's one of the places where that comes up. If you're like, well, I did this and this, so if you do, you know, this, it'll support me. Well, your characters don't have time to actually say that. But on the other side of it, for somebody who's never been in a combat and they're trying to figure out what are my options here, sometimes they're going to want that.
That's true.
That
but I think that the guy's comment, I think it bridged well beyond just new players. I think because this is something I see happening in existing groups with, you know, well-established players all the time. So I think it's just, it's for everybody. So certainly for new players, yeah, it is, but it's everywhere.
It does get irritating when you do have veteran players and, you know, and you're in a tactical situation, a very rules-heavy situation, and you've got other people kind of dictating what your character should be doing. Man, you really need to cast that spell. You really need to cast that spell. And while that may tactically be the best thing, I as a player might have a few other ideas that I want to try, which are still beneficial, but maybe not as beneficial as you want right at the moment. You know what I mean? And that bothers me, because who's playing the character here? I don't want to be just a resource so you can feel that you've triumphed in this battle. I want to be able to participate in whatever capacity I can do, whether it's good or bad.
It, to me, like I said, it ruins any realism that you can have when you're doing a combat by doing this stepping away, like, time out, let's discuss the strategy real quick when we really shouldn't be doing it. At the same time, I have seen instances where, like, characters are cross town from each other, but that player will still pipe in and say, you need to do this.
Well, that was
like,
going to be
shut up, because you're not even here. Your character isn't even here to interact with me.
Hold on, though. That was my second part of this, was the story aspect. Part one is the tacticals. Part two is when you're role playing. And I tell you, there is a phrase, and I think this is just because of personal bitterness, because it is completely true, completely accurate, and completely fair. But every time I've heard it, it's been said with an unnecessary level of volume, aggression, and usually a high-pitched voice, is, you're not there! Holy shit. It makes me want to kill. And you know what? It is completely accurate and completely fair. If Pat's in a role-playing situation, and I'm GMing, and the Lord of the City is grilling Pat, then Chad should not be able to pipe in and tell Pat how to respond or let him know secrets or techniques or whatever. But provided, once again, this is an established player, I think with a new player, especially if they're new to the hobby in general, but even maybe if they're just new to a setting or a game, they don't get all the nuances. And so I think it really is incumbent upon the GM to not put the players in the position of needing to do that. Now, the players shouldn't do it. But for example, in combat, you know, the GM ought to say to the player something like, you know that cold spell's not going to affect undead. Or, you know, if you call the captain of the starship by this title, it's going to offend him. Now, you can do it if you want, but I just want you to be aware that this is going to have a result, especially if they're new. Something else that I found that's helped is I use sort of a tutorial mode. If I'm running a game with players that are either new, once again, to that system, that setting, or new to gaming in general, and let's say we get into a combat round, let's say, well, what can I do? I might, in the first combat or two, only mention one or two abilities they have. On the flip side, I'm not going to rake them over the coals for failing to use every ability. The combat's going to be easier. And then the next combat, I may point out other skills, or a situation may come up that requires a different ability than they used to this point. And it's just like the tutorial level of a video game, where by the time you get through a certain series of role-playing or combat encounters, they've learned about a diversity of options without ever being put so under the gun they had to be an expert player using every trick in the book to have any chance of success.
I guess I would say, you know, ultimately it comes down to that one guiding rule that you've always professed through all these episodes, Dan, is, and you've mentioned earlier in this discussion, don't be an ass. Veteran players who are helping new players, absolutely you need to realize the fact that, yeah, this new player probably is looking for some advice and some help, but at the same time, you know what? Let them make mistakes. Even if you know what they're going to do is going to be disastrous, who cares? I mean, the GM is worth his salt. He's not going to have it be that disastrous as it could be. He's going to cut this new player some slack, which he should. He should cut them some slack in the beginning, because you do want to make it entertaining so they keep coming back. So fine, it's fine to offer some advice, but at the same time, put some sort of limit on yourself. Choose to not say anything, even if you want to.
Yeah, like in my Friday game, I've got a lot of people that are completely new to gaming, and even more that are new to the setting that I'm running. And you know what? There's been some times some NPCs have yelled at them or have not come off quite as well. There's been several combats where a character got knocked unconscious, but nobody's been killed. Nobody's lost anything in an unrecoverable way. Yeah, they've had an opportunity to learn from their mistakes, not be discouraged by them. And I think that right there is the key when you've gone too far. If either the helpfulness of other players is stifling, or the consequences brought on by the GM are discouraging, at that point, you've lost it.
Yeah, and I think from the GM's perspective here, because I think the poster was asking in specifically in terms of his game that he's running, I think if you are seeing this in your game and it's something that you're concerned about, or you know, or you think it's disruptive to the game, have a discussion about it with your players and lay down some ground rules and try to work something out. Tell them, you know, hey, I don't like this, or I think this is not really helpful, and why don't we just try to limit this kind of thing to where it's absolutely necessary or helpful to the player, but let's not go overboard.
You know, and I do think, too, from the GM's perspective, if a new player at the table asks, you know, and seems very genuine about their question, what should I do? Then it's really, I think, the GM's job to step in and maybe not necessarily give an exact course of action, but certainly provide maybe, you know, give them a multiple choice list of options and let them choose from there. If they do seem overwhelmed with those choices, or they seem paralyzed because they've gotten so much advice from everybody else, then the GM should supersede anything that those players are offering and saying, you know what, here's a few things that you could do, A, B, C, and go ahead, or do something different if you want. Coming from that authority position of that game master makes a little bit of a difference.
Other thing we want to talk about is
I'll listen this time so I can actually add something.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. You're going to have to add something because since just to let you guys listeners know, Wayne is on call for work tonight. So he keeps having to step in and out to take tech support calls. So
and I'll be on call at the end of the month.
Yeah. So if you don't hear a lot from Wayne this episode, that's why. He keeps coming and going from the mic. So, yeah, Chad, I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I need you to talk more this show.
Hey, I've been talking quite a bit.
You
so
have
far,
been,
so
Pat. This has been kind of cool.
Stepping up.
All right. So, yeah. Chad, what we're talking about today is playing multiple characters. Now, this is something that I have attempted several times in my role-playing career.
Oh, man, and that the was vast bread majority and butter for me when I was younger.
It has been catastrophic. But I can think of three times it has actually worked out. Now, just to be clear, when I talk about playing multiple characters, I am not talking about the GM running many NPCs. Now, some of the things we talk about will have implications for GMs, and there may be some commentary in here that is useful to GMs running NPCs, but I am specifically talking about a player who has more than one character that he or she can accurately refer to as their player character. And just to set some sort of boundaries on where this discussion goes, I am defining a person playing multiple characters whenever a player gets to make significant decisions for more than one character, even if one character has the preponderance of the spotlight. So if you have a character and a follower, but you get to roleplay what that follower does, even if they're only in the action 10% of the time, you're still playing multiple characters. All right. So with that,
is this going to turn into the pet debate where half of us are like, it's your pet, do whatever you want with it. And somebody's like, no, the GM has to run it because it has combat stats.
I think I do want to go there briefly, but only briefly. Most of what I have to talk about here is not that debate. You do raise a point that I think needs to be mentioned, which is if someone's going to play multiple characters, this needs to be clear with both the GM and the other players. The GM, for the sake of him understanding the implications for role-playing and combat balance, having another person present presents role-playing challenges and presents potential balance issues. It can get really difficult, just as with having 100,000 pets, if you have a gang or an army or a gaggle of followers to call on at any given moment. There is also, I think, some temptation that if one person's playing multiple characters, every player may say, well, why can't I play multiple characters?
That was something, I mean, that's going on in our current game. where you are playing two characters.
Right.
One
has, actually, at times now, three.
At times, three. But for the general purposes,
right,
it's going to be two characters.
Right.
Because we agreed on that. And it is a concern that I have. Not a, oh my God, you're going to break the game concern, but it is something that we broke this game up into chapters, and when we went into chapter two, a lot of things about the characters changed. You took on a second character. Wayne took on a sort of, we'll call it a familiar. Pat took on a kingdom. And you have multitudes of servants and armies and stuff. And that was something that when we went over to this chapter two, we advanced time a year, and I talked to the guy. I talked to all of you. I'm like, okay, Dan's getting a second character to play. Is that okay with everyone? Everyone didn't care. I'm like, does anyone else want one? And I say that not as an offer, but as a, I want to be fair, yet I don't want to go from a party of five to a party of 28.
Yeah.
And
or from party of five to a party of 10.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, because I think that that would be actually pretty interesting to play a role-playing game that has five people playing, yet has 10, 15, 20 characters. I think that would be a really cool thing to do. Not this game.
Well, and
you know, that's not how this game was.
There's also another angle you could do that would be pretty cool, though it's not directly relevant to this conversation, but same concept.
Mm-hmm.
You could play a game that is told from multiple perspectives,
right?
And everyone has two or three player characters, but is only playing one at a time.
Yeah.
So we're telling a story that takes place on two continents. Mm-hmm. Something like, was it Front Mission that you used to do?
Front Mission, yeah.
Yeah, Final Fantasy VIII did something
similar.
One took
place in Europe, one took place in Venezuela, and the plot lines.
Yeah.
Collided.
Or they could take place spanning across time, yeah, where one's what led up to a series of events and the other is the series of events, but you kind of go back and forth between flashbacks and the present, and people play multiple characters. That would be really badass. It takes one hell of a GM and storyteller to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason it's not relevant to this conversation, though I think it's a totally badass idea, is because of the fact that you're still only playing one character at a time. Yeah. At no point do you have the potential that Dan A and Dan B could both be present on the scene at the same time.
Right.
And so you're still fundamentally only playing one character. It just changes which one character you're playing. But no, Chad, you're absolutely right that you have to get the buy-in from the other players out of a sense of fairness.
Yeah.
I think you also have to have some trust for the person playing the other character or other characters,
mm-hmm,
that those additional party members are not simply going to be meat shields or accessories to the first character,
right,
that this is a real human being or elf or whatever it is. And this is not simply following you around for the sake of accessorizing your primary player character or stepping on the traps or, mm-hmm, running in front of the,
you know,
angry aliens.
Actually, my opinion on that is if they want to treat the additional player like that, that's fine with me. I don't mind that at all. But as the game goes on, as they are playing it like this, I will begin to take over that PC and I will start turning it into an NPC, and that NPC will not be happy treated, yeah, like that. And
if you can't play good with your toys, daddy's going to take them away.
Yeah. And you know what? The fourth, fifth, sixth time they say, okay, that hall that says do not enter, traps be here, and you send Joe the arrow catcher down that hallway, guess what? Joe the arrow catcher is not a PC anymore. Joe the arrow catcher turns around to you and says, catch your own goddamn arrows, and kicks your butt down the hall.
Yeah. Or as a GM, you can also do some things that are either passive aggressive or aggressive aggressive. Like, for example, Joe steps on a plate. Roll a d20 for his reflex save. Okay, he ducks. A lightning bolt goes down the hallway and strikes you instead.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
get
that,
the hint.
I think though that if you've got a character that is truly playing multiple PCs, mm-hmm, that there should be enough buy-in to that character where they're not going to just to treat it as,
yes,
sort of as a throwaway,
yeah,
henchman.
Oh yeah.
Now if they are, then you've got a problem. But I think if you're truly playing another character, that you will, I guess, for lack of a better term, start to develop that emotional bond with that character, just like you would with your main, or like the other characters do with their single character. So in that instance, it's not they're going to say, okay, you go down that hallway. It's that, oh, okay, well, I'm going to have, you know, Sir Wayne go down the hallway, and okay, so I'm going to check for traps and I'm going to roll for it and everything. Well, it's not just fire and forget.
Yeah, Pat, I think one of the first warning signs for GM this is not going well is when the person cannot or does not produce any noteworthy history or personality for that other character.
Yeah.
That when character A is super fleshed out and character B is a name and a class, yeah, you've got a problem.
True. Well, what about if the second character is a henchman? What if you're playing the equivalent of the Joker and I want to hire a couple of guys and I'll write up a background on them. I'll write up a history on them and I want to play them. But you know what? My character in character treats these guys like knuckleheads. And they are frickin' frack, and they take it.
I gotta say that as a GM, if that was the angle, my response would be, okay.
But the character, he writes frickin' frack up as really deep, good characters. And in character,
yeah,
they take it.
I guess. I think in special circumstances,
that's what the boss said.
I'd allow it if the person was playing it well. Because in that case, that is the correct context for it. I mean, exactly. That really is what they're supposed to be.
Yeah. And you're going into it with that context. Everyone knows that that's exactly what's going on. But again, Chad, I think like you were saying earlier, you do have to, as a GM, still have to watch out for, you know, over abuse of that, because frickin' frack at some point are going to get upset and may try and kill the Joker. They probably are ultimately going to fail, but still, it could happen. You know, everyone has their limits that they get tired of getting pushed.
I think for me, I think you've sort of found the dividing line. I think it is whether or not it's a true PC that you've got or it's a henchman. And just to set the record straight, I have actually never played in a campaign that had like a true henchman for characters. Like there are rules like fighters and paladins, you know, they can have followers or henchmen, whatever they were called at that point, where you attract a certain number.
Yeah.
And this is just my opinion. I think that if you truly do have henchmen, that they should not be played by you. They should be treated as NPCs and played
and done
by the GM.
Yeah, we're talking henchmen here. We're not talking...
Well, I'm even saying like your example of frickin' frack. Uh-huh. I think if it's truly, these are the guys that you played and they're your henchmen to do that, but I don't think the player should be playing those guys. I think that that needs to go to the GM.
Well, I disagree with you, and I will throw the example of our current game. All the listeners know what our current game is,
well,
right?
Let me give the three examples of where I played multiple characters and it worked out well, because I think these may serve as interesting discussion points. And one of them, last of them, is going to be necessary, I think, to the point you're going to make.
Right.
The first was several years ago. I was playing a second edition D&D game. I had a mage and I took whatever, I can't remember what the thing was, but it allowed me to have a follower. And the follower I picked, it was a young woman. It was not a sexualized thing. It was just,
I'm out.
It was like,
oh, because it's a woman, there has to be a question.
Yeah,
if it's
exactly
a sex thing.
Well,
yeah,
unfortunately, there does.
Yeah.
And it was more someone that he saw as a daughter. And I wrote
a sexy daughter.
A sexy daughter.
Uh-huh.
And
that's
I wrote
hello.
A fairly detailed
Were you
background
a farmer?
Personality. For
I'm just curious.
I wrote a fairly detailed personality background for her. And the game executed really well. The second time that I did it worked out well. And let me stress that most of the times I've tried this, it's just been a total abortion. But the second time I did it and it worked out well was in a Transformers game. I played an entire 5-part combiner. I played something like that. It was the equivalent of like Bruticus or Devastator entirely by myself. And it worked out wonderfully. And I'll explain made it work in a minute. But the final one is the one that Chad's talking about now, which is in our current game. I'm playing a Null, and I have established since game one that one of the goals of my character, his clan has been broken, is he is trying to reestablish a new clan from the remnants of this Nullish invasion. And so it was his stated goal from the start to gather up other Nulls. And during the break between the chapters, I approached Chad, and ending chapter one,
he was holding a gun. Yeah. I just said yes to everything.
And I left a quarter on your belly. And ending chapter one, I came out of that with three Nulls that were already basically in my pocket. I wasn't playing them. Mm-hmm. It just understood they were there. They're following the party at a distance. But by the time that we started chapter two, I specifically said, do you mind if I introduce, we use the cleric character class, but this is basically a Nullish medicine man or a Nullish shaman. And I gave you a personality and background for him, and as we go forward, I now actually have two character sheets, and we'll be playing my original Noel and this shaman that is following him around. And so now, with that stated, with that little bit of background, because so far this has worked out, I think, at least really well. So with that stated...
And mechanically speaking, what Dan is doing is, just mechanically, not story-wise, this shaman is basically a henchman. He is there to be a heal bot. Party's wiped. He needs to heal. That's mechanically.
Yes.
The story, Dan has written a background for the guy and has come up with this great personality. The personality is awesome. And said this before, I like him more than I like your original character. I love your second character. Love the guy. But Dan is playing him really, really well. And I've never played multiple characters in a game as a player. But if I were to do it, I would use this template that Dan is doing of one guy is the main character and the other is a secondary character.
Essentially that almost one, an active wingman.
Yes, exactly. One guy gets the spotlight. He's the hero. Dan's journey, your hero's journey is right. About Gnarl, the main Gnoll. And that's what the story is about. This other character, what's his name?
Rot is what the humans call him.
Rot is a secondary character to the story. He's like a support character. And Dan throws in interactions between the two. If I present an NPC, 9.999 times out of 10, Gnarl is the one who talks to the NPC. Rot gives it color. After the encounter, there's an encounter, you know, Rot speaks up and says something and interacts maybe with someone else or interacts with Gnarl. But really, so far, you've only played Rot like 10% of the time.
Yeah.
And you played Gnarl the other 90% of the time. And Rot has his own voice. He has his own personality. He has his own motivations. He has his own character. And I like it. And I really like how that's done. I think that if you take two characters and try to play them as primary and both grabbing the spotlight, it just gets a little muddled. It gets a little confused. And I think that a better way to do it is to have this main character and have the support character be that, not from a mechanical standpoint,
right,
but from a role-playing standpoint of that this is a supporting character. This is a character that makes the main actor look good. And I really enjoy how you're doing that. And like I said, if I ever do a game where I play as a two characters, that's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to use the second character to support that main character and from a role-playing standpoint.
Yeah, you know, Chad, that was the way that I would advise people to do it, because the most significant example I can think of from my past when we did that was we went through the GDQ series for first edition. You know, in the last one, you're traveling to Loth's home plane and going to take her on, and there was no way with the
hell are you talking about? GDQ? Loth?
No. From the old,
I know, I get the Loth reference, but I'm not sure what GDQ stands for.
GDQ, the G series, the Against the Giants, and then the D is Descent.
Oh, yes, of course.
And then Q is Queen of the Demon Wind Pip. So altogether, it was GDQ. Anyway.
I think we were like 2 or 3 when this came out.
Okay.
That might explain some of it. Yeah, but at any rate, sure. classic modules, by the way, if you ever get the chance to go through them, they're fun.
Best stuff Abraham ever wrote.
Oh yeah, he was not only did Father Abraham have many sons, he was also a hell of an adventure writer. So
wow.
But anyway, there was no way with our group of players that we had a party of significant power to travel to this plane to take on the Queen of the Demon Web Pits. There was just no way we could do it. So we did. We all had at least a minimum of two characters, and one guy even was running three. And we ran it in essentially that way, where one player or one character that you had was your main guy, because he was your main character, and the other ones were essentially NPCs that became PCs that we had acquired and met along the way and went that final adventure with us. And yeah, and that's how we did it. One character was prominent. The other guy was in the background. Certainly when we had party discussions, trying to make sure as a player that if they had a differing opinion, they expressed it. And there were some times when that happened. And so that made for some good role playing. But yeah, there was no way you could, especially for the guy who was running three characters, it would have been impossible for him to really be, you know, full on with all three, because then they would all have suffered. But he just kept his main character, and the other two sub characters hung out in the background, still contributed when they needed to. But you know, the main character for them, you know, was the center stage.
I've got three specific bits of advice that I've picked up over the years on how to run multiple characters. But before I do, I want to throw out one other thing that I found is a real boon of having multiple characters. And this was an unintended bonus of what I'm doing right now, because there are two main PCs I'm playing, but then there's a third sort of PC NPC that I just kind of pick up every now and again, who is a Gnoll that just kind of hangs out as Pat's bodyguard.
Yeah,
but
Well, not to step on the shore, but yeah, I like what you're doing with this guy, because this is the Gnarl and Rot are off doing something that's away from the main group. This allows you, playing the third guy allows you to play with the main group.
That is exactly it. That if you have multiple characters, especially if they do not walk around in a mob, it is a great way to make sure that you stay in the action and the party stays together. Because let's be honest, a role-playing game is not about entertaining the characters. It's about entertaining the players.
Right.
And so if Pat's player character and Wayne's player character are in a room and my main Gnoll is not there, as long as a Gnoll from my little band is present, I have a character.
You know, this just, I know what you're doing here, Dan. I just realized it because of our banter topic. You're just doing this so that you can always be around to interject what should be done.
Yes.
I see your dastardly plan.
So you can never hear that. You're not there.
Exactly. Screw you, I am. I've got 15 characters. I'm everywhere.
As a game master, I find that perfectly acceptable. Because
you don't have to keep getting the party back together.
Well, the primary job, in my opinion, of a game master is distributing the spotlight.
Right.
Spotlights on Dan. Spotlights on Wayne. Spotlights on Pat. Spotlights on everybody equally. And that allows me to always be juggling the spotlight in a fair way.
Well, and Chad, you made a great point when we were outlining this topic, that when a GM measures out his spotlight giving, the one thing the GM must keep in mind, this goes back to what I just said, it's about entertaining the players, not entertaining the characters. If I'm playing two characters, I don't get twice the spotlight.
Oh my God, I just had an idea for a role-playing game, the TCG. So
where the
it's like everybody's a player and you have one game master. The game master mechanic is different. He has spotlight points and he has his own objective, making a good game,
right?
And I don't know how he would achieve this, and that the players have their own objective, being the number one player or getting the most amount of spotlight points.
It could have a great traitor mechanic too. If you randomly dish out cards and one guy will be that guy.
Yeah, that guy.
And he just has all these jackass like event cards he gets to play throughout the game to disrupt it.
Yeah, and then
his job is to ruin the game.
Yeah, there's like two different mechanics. There's like a combat mechanic where the players are like combating monster cards that the guy's throwing out. Then there's like a role play mechanic where there's plot points that are being thrown out and you're trying to amass plot points and spotlight points. And you don't roll the dice. I play a card that is the natural 20. And then you play on me the card of dice aren't with you tonight. It's like the maximum number turns into its opposite. So like a 20 turns into a 1.
Huh. This is a new game we're going to have to develop. But in the meantime, the point being that you, as a game master, the fact that a guy has two characters, that does not mean you give him twice the spotlight. In fact, doing so only encourages a whole lot of negative behaviors. So be sure that you are dividing the spotlight by player, not by
character. Yeah.
And that was a great point you raised that I think really bears emphasis.
That's another thing that I have not seen lately, but I think that to me, it is the sign of a very mature group that is working well together. And you have that whole thing that Chris hates, trust between player and GM, and where you can have players who take over NPC. So I'm role playing with Wayne and Pat and Chris, and I'm the game master, and Dan is off doing something. His character is off doing something. The party is split. I have these NPCs that are interacting with him, and then I just lean over to Dan and I say, Dan, jump in so-and-so and play him. Do the best of your ability. Ad lib it. Go crazy. Yeah. I'll deal with it. And that way the role-playing keeps going. And the game master can do his primary job, distribution of spotlight.
That reminds me of back when Chris was playing the RML9 adventure. All right, so
the Z86 adventure.
My three tips that I have found seem to make this work.
Don't bet on three-legged horses.
Number one, interact. You have two characters. They are not, in all probability, I guess depending on the game, maybe they are, but they are not, in all probability, one person or one mind. It is okay for them to talk to each other. Now, there's absolutely an inherent awkwardness in carrying on a conversation with yourself. I totally accept that. It is weird to do. But even in little doses, have them talk to each other, because if they're bestest buds or employer and henchmen or whatever it may be, and they never talk to each other, that's just really weird. It just, it really, I think, breaks the suspension of disbelief. The second thing, and this will also help you with point one, alternate voice. There are people out there who are really great voice actors. There are people who are horrible at it. I wouldn't say I'm the worst I've heard, but I certainly do fall towards that end. I'm not a great voice actor. But the simple matter of fact is, even if you just have a low-pitched voice and a high-pitched voice, if you can do something, come up with little mannerisms, little quirks, slang terms. One of them speaks educated. One of them speaks more guttural. Anything to distinguish their voices one from the other. That will help bring a lot of character to the table, and also stops you, if the party picks up on it, from you constantly having to say, okay, so-and-so saying, and then you role play it. Because if you can just kick off on that voice, in our current campaign, I do my main Knoll really deep in the throat.
Okay, give us examples of your two Knolls.
I'm not going to do my Knoll.
Don't do it.
I'll do my Knoll voice if Pat does his German voice.
Oh, yes.
The gauntlet's thrown down. If Pat does his German voice, I'll do my Knoll voice.
Ah, yeah. That is very good. I will do my German voice for a while.
All right. So my main Knoll,
I feel like I'm in a fantasy land somewhere.
Yeah.
The main Knoll I do really deep in the throat. So I may say something like, "Shurish, I think we ought to bring him forward." For the other Knoll, I do more of an airy voice that's more kind of spoken from the roof of the mouth. I try to keep that guttural sound. "Gnarl, I am not so sure that I trust this man." And so it's not a huge difference. I'm not claiming to be.
No, but they're very distinct.
Yeah, they're very
like
distinct.
You said, we recognize the difference immediately.
And then there's a third Knoll I do that I speak purely from the top and front of the mouth, with which might say, "I will guard you as long as my Shurish instructs me to do so." I speak him much more high-pitched and from the front of the mouth. Once again, I'm not a good voice actor. There is something.
Which Knoll is it that you speak that sounds like a Jersey dock worker?
The final one?
Yeah.
He's named, but he's more of a background, all but an NPC. He's the head of the guard of my Knolls, and the main thing he's used for now is he follows Pat around, because there's things my character wants to do, my main player character wants to do, but he doesn't want to let Pat out of his sight because he considers himself honor-bound to protect him. So he always keeps one of his higher guards next to Pat's side. But when Chad has someone run into the king's court and address Pat, I have a Knoll there that's present I can play.
Right.
But once again, these distinct voices help make these characters more real both to you and the people you're playing with. And that's something that I've done every time I successfully pulled it off. And then number three, and this is not necessary, but I have found it helps. In fact, once again, the times that I've gotten this to work, this has been present in two of the three times, create tension between them. With the two guys I'm playing right now, the Knoll and the other Knoll that's following him around, they're actually pretty annoyed by each other.
Yeah, they don't like each other at all.
And I won't get into the game and sort of why they're together, but yeah, there's a tension there. They don't have to perfectly get along just because both are played by you. I mean, think of it this way. Look throughout your role-playing career. Surely you can come up with two player
characters. Don't call me Shirley.
We miss you, Leslie. Yes, oh, Leslie.
But you can certainly come up with two player characters that if you put in a room together would hate each other. There's no reason they can't be in the same campaign. That's not to say that's automatic fact. This is not black and white advice of if you play multiple PCs, they must hate each other. But
in fact, I'll even give a warning on that, too. You do it fine, but that can be played up too much.
Right.
And I think, to me, one of the main dangers, because role-playing games are dangerous and they'll pop your eye out. And one of the main dangers of playing multiple PCs by a single person is the talking to yourself syndrome.
Yeah.
Where there's a role-playing moment, you've talked to yourself back and forth, and it's just a moment. It's just a little bit, and anybody else can jump into it. But the whole PC1 says something to PC2, says something to PC1, and says back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, with everybody just watching one guy monologue talk to himself. Well, not even monologue, talking to himself in two different characters. If there's a lot of tension there between the characters, that tension has to release, and that tension has to get out through role-playing. And how do you present that without talking to yourself?
And the more complicated you make the relationship, the more you have a ton to resolve internally.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that last one is a fact. I'm just saying
Because everything else we're saying is fact.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everything else is objective fact you can find on Wikipedia.
Absolutely.
But this one point...
Here, let me log into Wikipedia.
Yeah, we'll put it in there. But this one point, I would say something that I have found helps. Because, look, even think of it this way. Even among best of friends, there are things they disagree on. And in the same way, unless the intentional character interaction is one guy's a total sycophant, and that alone could be an entertaining interaction,
yeah,
then they're going to disagree on stuff. And that level of disagreement really does enhance it. And I guess thinking about the sycophant example, maybe it's not disagreement so much as just colorful interactions.
Yeah.
They don't have to be constant, but just peppered in there somewhere.
Yeah.
These two guys have something, or guy and growl or whatever, have something going on between them.
I think it's a good idea, too, to... And I say this completely for absolutely selfish reasons, because I like Dan's secondary character more than I like his primary character. I think it's good because we said that, you know, have one be the primary and have one be a support guy. I think it's good to switch that around sometimes.
Yeah.
In mid game, just to where the secondary guy is grabbing more spotlight and then the primary guy is taking more of a back
seat. I think the one thing I'd have to be careful about, dangerous, once again,
danger.
People might die.
Danger, danger, danger.
Is
danger.
With these two characters, one of them is built into the group template.
Yes.
The other is only attached to the group template through the first.
Yeah.
So if I was to have the first be removed and the second take the spotlight, the group template would probably break down on that character because he was never meant to be the link into the party.
Yeah.
And so I think it could be done, but we would have to find some way to either, A, only keep him in the spotlight for limited times, a game or a few hours or a few minutes, or find some reason along the way where he would actually stick around if the main character left.
Right.
Another thing, this is should be a minor thing, but it's still something you got to think through is record keeping. Can you keep up with the paperwork for multiple characters? Some games that's easy because there's not much paperwork. Some games that's hard, and of course you make it harder the more characters you add. But if you've got a lot of paperwork, you don't want to slow the game down because you've got half a dozen dudes lined up in front of you and you've got to go down each one and read spell lists or check powers or write down damage or reduce the number of bullets they've got in a magazine.
I have this image of like a VFW hall and all these old ladies playing bingo and they have 30 bingo cards in front of them.
I've seen it with role-playing
games. That is exactly
games.
What it's like because you've got your character sheets arranged, you know, and what you do, of course, is once you find how your characters line up in the initiative order, you shuffle your papers to get them in that order. And then, your turn. So you go up, you make all your actions, cross everything off, shuffle to the next one. Oh, wait for somebody else. And you got to shuffle that. Oh, yeah, big time. That's exactly what it's like. It's like old ladies playing bingo.
How do you make a little old lady say, fuck?
How?
Have two other little old ladies say, bingo.
So I have a question to ask you guys on this point. There's something that I call, I don't know the official name for it, but I call a community game.
Okay.
A community game is where we're all playing. You, me, Chris, Wayne. And each of us have multiple characters. Where I could be a father and a son and then the mother and then the next door neighbor. And those are my characters. And then you could have the captain of the guard and his two lieutenants and the squire. And those are your characters and so on and so on and so on.
I know what you're talking about. I've never played in one of these games, but I've seen them before.
I've never played in one either. And the game goes on for a long time. This is a years and years long campaign.
Right.
And so we're going to be running an adventure with the captain of the guard, the father, the king, and the chancellor. And then they all have this adventure and they all do this stuff. And then we say, okay, that was really fun. Let's continue the story from a different angle and we'll do different. Wayne might still be playing the chancellor and you still might be playing the captain of the guard, but we cycle out into our, it's like, I don't feel like playing the father anymore. I'm going to play the son. And the son is affected by the father's actions and what happened. And we grow the character and then he's added in and he's into the party now. And even mid-game where it's just like, okay, at this point, the father would step up and say, you know, son, it's too dangerous. You're too young. You are going home and I am taking up this quest, this mantle of responsibility. And they send the son home. And what do you guys think of that? Juggling all those kind of this sort of community of PCs.
I think the hardest thing would be to keep track of the distinct personalities. There's record keeping, but not just at the level of powers and equipment. But the level of personality, the level of history, the level of who hates whom and why.
Some people are into that.
No, I will see.
Some people are into tracking
that. I know people
that
have run these games. I've seen these games played. I personally have never played in one, and so I can't speak with too great authority.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest concern for me, if someone said, hey, let's play one of these, would be, wow, how do you keep all that stuff straight?
A wiki?
I guess.
We did something similar to that, though, back when we used to play Battletech. Because that type of thing you described, now it's not exactly how you described it, Chad, but it was very similar in the sense that...
Oh, I'm sure there's like dozens of variations.
Well, the mercenary unit that we had as players, it was a large mercenary unit, large enough where we could have a number of different characters who would cross paths all the time because they're in the same unit. And so when we would go on various actual mech warrior adventures... That was the thing. It's like, okay, this guy said, well, I'm going to play this character this time. And I'd be like, nah, you know what? I'm kind of feeling this way. I'm going to play this particular character. I'm going to, you know, and then so on and so forth around the table. So where it was a different mixed group every time. And since we were out of the mechs, in that scale, it didn't necessarily matter too much from a tactical basis. But we had all these different players crossing paths, but yet still within that same family.
Yeah, to me, that example feels much more like you're just... really playing one character. I mean, because you really are just playing one PC at a time.
At a time.
Even though you do have multiples that you can draw from. I think that's much closer to just like the traditional sense of playing.
Yeah.
Because even, and like you said, when your interactions between your multiple characters will be at a transition point where you're going, you know, transitioning between maybe adventures, you'll do a little bit of it there, but it's not like you're not constantly playing four characters at a time. So
it's not exactly the same, and you are right to a certain point, Pat, but it's still at the same time, it does have a different feel and a different vibe to it, because there are experiences that one of your characters has that your other one doesn't, but yet that second character who doesn't have that first experience is still going to interact with that other character from that player who was in that first experience. And it's just different.
I think the last point I've got on this, probably wonderfully illustrated, Chris, by this example you bring up, which is, I mentioned record keeping, but there's another issue you have to keep straight, which is metagame knowledge. The fact that you're not there can now come up within your own group of PCs. That if I'm playing two guys, I have to keep straight which of them heard or knows what information.
I don't say that, do I? Do I do the you're not there?
No, you don't.
In fact, I have a bit more of a
feminine shrill to yours when you do it.
That's it.
That's what it is right there.
I have probably said it at some point myself, although I'm usually not the whiny bitch mode. I'll just sort of do like one of those,
hold on, you're not there, I'm not here,
I'm not going to say anything.
Yeah, I think I do that.
I just try to find other ways to say it as a GM, that if I get somebody butting in, I'll be like, hold on. They're the center of the action. Yeah. And I found most role players are pretty good self-policing. They'll open their mouth and be like, oh, never mind, I'm not there. But anyway, if you're playing two guys, three guys, four guys, 10 guys, you have to keep straight which of those guys was around when such and such occurred or such and such was said. And the more you are playing, the harder that gets. And that's not something that's going to appear in your character sheet. I mean, unless you keep books of notes.
If I ever do that, if I'm playing a character set like that, they'll have a hive mind. So it won't be an issue.
Well, and you know what? While my current group of two or three PCs don't have a hive mind, the fact that they're part of the same organization, communicating frequently, and two of them are almost never apart.
Yeah.
That alone means the chance of one knowing something the other doesn't is pretty minimal. And so the facts one knows the other doesn't are typically so significant that they're central to the character and therefore easy to remember. This is a topic that I think is interesting enough. There might be more to come back and say on this in a later episode. But we're getting close to the hour mark, at least pre-edit, so we'll go ahead and wrap this one up here. As always, check the show notes for all kinds of stuff related to this episode. We thank you guys for tuning in. We look forward to seeing you at Fear the Con, and we will catch you next time.
See GDQ. Ya.
What is that?
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.